exclamations of how awful, he was at heart completely indifferent to Bezdomny's fate, and did not even feel sorry for him. "Good man, that's right," thought Ryukin with cynical, self-lacerating malice. Cutting short his story about schizophrenia, he asked, "Archibald Archibaldovich, may I have a little vodka?" The pirate put on a sympathetic face and whispered, "I understand, right away," and he signaled a waiter. A quarter of an hour later, Ryukin was sitting all by himself, hunched over a plate of carp, downing glass after glass. He was coming to realize and to acknowledge that he could not rectify anything in his life. He could only forget. The poet had wasted his night while others were feasting, and now he realized it could never be brought back. He had only to raise his head from the table lamp up to the sky to realize that the night was gone forever. The waiters were hurriedly pulling the tablecloths off the tables. The cats, nosing about the veranda, had a morning look about them. Day was bearing down on the poet with full force. Chapter 7. The Evil Apartment. If, on the following morning, anyone had said to Stjopa Likhodyeyev, "Stjopa, you'll be shot if you don't get up this minute," Stjopa would have replied in a numb, faintly audible voice, "Shoot me, do whatever you like to me, but I'm not getting up." It wasn't just a matter of getting up. He didn't even think he could open his eyes, because if he did, lightning would strike and blast his head to bits. A heavy bell was clanging inside his head. Brown spots with fiery green rims were floating between his eyeballs and his closed lids, and to cap things off, he felt nauseated, and his nausea seemed to be related to the sounds coming from a persistent phonograph. Stjopa was trying to remember something, but the only thing he could remember was that yesterday, he didn't know where, he had been standing, napkin in hand, trying to kiss a lady and promising he would visit her the next day at noon on the dot. The lady had refused him, saying, don't, I won't be home. But Stjopa had been insistent, "I think I'll just come anyway." Who this lady was, what time it was now, or what the day or month, Stjopa hadn't the slightest idea. Even worse, he couldn't remember where he was. That, at least, he'd tried to figure out by ungluing the lids of his left eye. In the semi-darkness, something glowed dimly. Stjopa finally recognized the mirror and realized he was in his own room, lying flat on his back on his own bed, that is, in the bedroom on the bed that used to belong to the jeweler's widow. At this point, his head started to pound so badly that he closed his eyes and began groaning. Let us explain. Stjopa Likhodyeyev, the director of the Variety Theatre, regained consciousness that morning in the apartment that he shared with the late Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz in a large six-story building on Sadovaya Street. It should be said that the apartment, number 50, had long had, if not a bad, then at least an odd reputation. 2 years before, it had belonged to the widow of the jeweler de Fougeray. Anna Frantsevna de Fougeray, a very businesslike and respectable woman of 50, let out 3 of her 5 rooms to lodgers. One of them was apparently named Bielomut. The other's name has been lost. And it was 2 years ago that inexplicable things began happening in the apartment. People started disappearing without a trace. Once, on a day off, a policeman appeared, summoned the second lodger, whose name has been lost, into the front hall and said that he had been asked to come down to the police station for a minute in order to sign something. The lodger told Anfisa, Anna Frantsevna's longtime devoted housekeeper, to tell anyone who called that he would be back in 10 minutes, whereupon he went off with the policeman, who was correctly attired in white gloves. Not only did he not return in 10 minutes, he never returned at all. And the most astonishing thing was that the policeman evidently disappeared along with him. The pious and, to be blunt, superstitious Anfisa came right out and told the distressed Anna Frantsevna that it was witchcraft, pure and simple, and that she knew exactly who it was that had spirited away both the lodger and the policeman, only she didn't want to say, because it was almost nighttime. Well, as everyone knows, once witchcraft gets started, there's no stopping it. The second lodger disappeared, I recall, on a Monday, and on Wednesday, Bielomut vanished, as if he had fallen through the earth, albeit in different circumstances. In the morning, a car came to take him to work as usual, and the car did leave with him, but it did not bring anyone back, and never returned again. Madame Bielomut's grief and horror defied description, but both, alas, were of short duration. On the night when she and Anfisa returned from her dacha, where Anna Frantsevna had hurried off to for some reason, she discovered that Bielomut's wife was no longer in the apartment, and what is more, the two rooms occupied by the Bielomuts had both been sealed. 2 days passed somehow. On the third, a sleepless Anna Frantsevna again left hurriedly for her dacha. It hardly needs to be said that she did not return either. Left all alone, Anfisa cried her eyes out and then went to bed after 1 in the morning. What happened to her after that is a mystery, but the residents of the other apartments said they thought they had heard knocking sounds in number 50 all night long, and they thought the lights were on until daybreak. In the morning, it turned out that Anfisa was missing too. All kinds of tales circulated in the building about the accursed apartment and the people who had disappeared. For example, according to one of them, the dry and pious Anfisa had allegedly worn a chamois pouch on her emaciated breast, which contained 25 large diamonds that had belonged to Anna Frantsevna. According to another story, the dacha which Anna Frantsevna had hurriedly visited allegedly had a woodshed where priceless valuables were found, including those same diamonds as well as Tsarist gold coins. And there were other such stories, but we cannot vouch for what we do not know. In any event, the apartment stood vacant and under seal for only a week. And then who moved in but the late Berlioz and his wife, and the aforementioned Stjopa and his wife? Not unexpectedly, as soon as they settled into the accursed apartment, devilish things started happening to them, too. In the space of a month, both wives disappeared, but not without a trace. Berlioz's wife was said to have been seen in Kharkov with a ballet master, and Stjopa's wife supposedly turned up on Bozhodomka Street, where, word had it, the director of the Variety Theater had used his many connections to get her a room on the condition that she never set foot on Sadovaya Street again. And so Stjopa groaned. He wanted to call Grunia the maid and ask her for some pyramidon, but he was sufficiently in touch with reality to realize that was pointless, since she naturally would not have any pyramidon. He tried calling Berlioz for help, groaning 2 times, "Misha! Misha!" But as you yourself can understand, he got no reply. The most total silence reigned in the apartment. After wiggling his toes, Stjopa could tell that he was still in his socks. He palpated his thigh with a trembling hand to determine if he had his trousers on, but he couldn't be sure. Finally, seeing that he was abandoned and alone, and that there was no one to help him, he decided to get up, whatever the superhuman effort it cost. Stjopa unglued his eyelids, looked in the mirror, and saw a man with hair sticking up all over his head, with swollen eyelids and a bloated face covered with black stubble. The man was wearing a dirty shirt with a collar and tie, long johns and socks. That was how he saw himself in the mirror. And next to the mirror, he saw a man he did not know, who was dressed in black and wearing a black beret. Stjopa sat down on the bed and tried as hard as he could to focus his bloodshot eyes on the stranger. It was he who broke the silence, intoning in a low, somber voice with a foreign accent, "Good day, most kind Stepan Bogdanovich." There was a pause, after which Stjopa made a huge effort and said, "What do you want?" He was shocked not to recognize his own voice. The word what came out in a treble, you in a bass, and want did not come out at all. The stranger gave a friendly smile, took out a large gold watch with a diamond triangle on the cover, listened to it ring 11 times, and then said, 11 o'clock, I've been waiting for you to wake up for exactly an hour because you told me to be here at 10. And here I am. Stjopa felt for his trousers on the chair next to the bed and whispered, excuse me, put on his trousers and asked hoarsely, would you kindly tell me your name? It was hard for him to talk. With every word he spoke, someone stuck a needle in his brain, causing him hellish pain. What? You've forgotten my name, too? Here the stranger smiled. Sorry, croaked Stjopa, sensing that his hangover was blessing him with a new symptom. The floor by the bed seemed to him to have vanished somewhere, and he was just on the verge of flying headfirst down to the devil's mother in the underworld. My dear Stepan Bogdanovich, said the visitor with a piercing smile, Pyramidon will not help you. Follow the wise old rule, cure like with like. The only thing that will restore you to life is 2 shots of vodka with some hot and spicy hors d'oeuvres. However sick he was, Stjopa was shrewd enough to know that once he had been found in such a state, it was better to admit to everything. To be honest, he began, barely able to move his tongue, yesterday, I may have had a bit too. Not another word, the visitor replied, moving his armchair over to the side. Stjopa, his eyes bulging, saw a small table and a tray, covered with sliced white bread, pressed caviar in a glass bowl, white marinated mushrooms on a plate, something in a saucepan, and finally, vodka in a mammoth decanter that had belonged to the jeweler's wife. Stjopa was particularly struck by the fact that the decanter was sweating with frost, which was understandable since it had been placed in a shallow bowl packed with ice. In a word, the table was set flawlessly, impeccably. The stranger prevented Stjopa's astonishment from assuming morbid proportions by deftly pouring him half a glass of vodka. "Won't you have some?" squeaked Stjopa. "With pleasure." Stjopa raised his glass to his lips with a wobbly hand while the stranger downed the contents of his in a single gulp. As he was munching on some caviar, Stjopa managed to get out the words, "Wouldn't you like some hors d'oeuvres?" "Thank you, I never eat hors d'oeuvres," the stranger replied and poured a second round. They uncovered the saucepan and found sausages in tomato sauce. And soon the accursed greenness which had been floating in front of Stjopa's eyes melted away. Words started to come out, and most important of all, Stjopa began remembering things. Namely, that yesterday he had been in Schodnia at the dacha of the sketchwriter Hustov, and had been taken there in a taxicab by Hustov himself. He even remembered that they had hired the taxicab at the Metropole, and that some actor had been there too, or maybe he wasn't an actor, with a portable phonograph. Yes, 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 it had all happened at the dacha. Then he recalled that the dogs had howled because of the phonograph. Only the lady whom Stjopa had wanted to kiss remained a mystery. The devil only knew who she was. Maybe she worked in radio. Maybe not. Thus, the events of the previous day gradually became clearer, although at the moment the present day interested Stjopa more, especially the stranger in his bedroom, with vodka and hors d'oeuvres to boot. It would be a good idea to clear that up. Well, I hope you can remember my name now. But Stjopa merely smiled shamefacedly and shrugged. Really? I have the feeling that you drank port after vodka. Forgive me, but how could you do such a thing? May I ask that this go no further? Said Stjopa obsequiously. Of course, but naturally I can't speak for Hustov. Do you know Hustov, too? I saw the man briefly in your office yesterday, but one quick look at his face was enough to convince me that he's a bastard, a wrecker, a toady, and a yes-man. Absolutely true, thought Stjopa, who was struck by the accuracy, precision, and pithiness of this characterization of Hustov. So although the previous day was reassembling itself piece by piece, the director of the variety still felt anxious. There was still a huge gaping hole to be accounted for, and there was no way that Stjopa could have seen the stranger in the beret in his office yesterday. "Professor of Black Magic Volant," said the visitor weightily, seeing Stjopa's consternation, and he gave him a precise account of what had happened. He had arrived in Moscow from abroad yesterday and had gone to see Stjopa immediately to propose a performance at the Variety Theatre. Stjopa had phoned the Moscow Regional Entertainment Commission to receive approval. Stjopa grew pale and blinked his eyes. "Signed a contract with Professor Volant for 7 performances," Stjopa's mouth opened, "and arranged for Volant to come by this morning at 10 o'clock to iron out the details." And so Volant had come. When he arrived, he was met by the maid, Grunia, who explained that she came in daily and had only just arrived herself, that Berlioz was not at home, and that if the visitor wished to see Stepan Bogdanovich, then he could go into his bedroom himself. Stepan Bogdanovich was such a sound sleeper that she would not try to wake him up. Seeing the condition Stepan Bogdanovich was in, the artiste sent Grunia to the nearest specialty store for vodka and hors d'oeuvres, to the drugstore for ice, and... "Let me settle up with you," whispered the crushed Stjopa as he tried to find his wallet. "Oh, don't be silly," exclaimed the guest artiste, and would hear nothing more of it. And so the vodka and hors d'oeuvres were accounted for, but even so it was still painful to look at Stjopa. He had absolutely no recollection of a contract, and could have sworn that he had not seen this Volant fellow yesterday. Yes, Hustov had been there, but Volant had not. "May I have a look at the contract?" asked Stjopa softly. "By all means, by all means." Stjopa took a look at the paper and froze. Everything was in order. First, there was Stjopa's own dashing signature, and then a note written slantwise in the margin in the financial director Rimsky's hand authorizing an advance payment to Volant of 10,000 rubles from the 35,000 due him for 7 appearances. Finally, there was Volant's signature confirming his receipt of the 10,000 ruble advance. "What is all this?" thought the miserable Stjopa, and his head began to spin. Was he beginning to have ominous memory lapses? But, it goes without saying, after he had been shown the contract, any further expression of surprise would be simply impolite. Stjopa asked his guest's permission to step out for a moment, and, as he was, in his socks, he ran to the phone in the front hall. On the way, he shouted in the direction of the kitchen, "Grunia!" But nobody answered. Here he glanced at the door to Berlioz's study, which was close to the front hall, and at that point he was, as they say, struck dumb. There was a huge wax seal hanging on a string attached to the door handle. "Oh, great!" roared a voice in Stjopa's head. "That's all I need!" And at this point Stjopa's thoughts began racing down 2 tracks. But as always happens in a catastrophe, they were both going in the same direction, and only the devil knows where they were headed. It is hard even to convey the confusion that reigned in Stjopa's head. First, there was the devilish character with the black beret, the cold vodka, and the improbable contract, and now, if you please, to top it all off, a seal on the door. If you told anyone that Berlioz had done something bad, no one would believe it. Truly, no one would believe it. But a seal is a seal. Yes, indeed. And here some highly unpleasant little thoughts began stirring in Stjopa's brain regarding an article which, as luck would have it, he had recently foisted on Mikhail Alexandrovich for publication in his journal. And just between us, it was a stupid article. and pointless, too. And it paid a pittance. The recollection of the article triggered another recollection of a questionable conversation which had taken place here in the dining room on the evening of April 24th when Stjopa was having supper with Mikhail Alexandrovich. That is, of course, one would never call the conversation questionable in the full sense of the word. Stjopa would never have entered into such a conversation, but it had been a conversation on a needless topic. It would have been just as easy, citizens, for him not to have engaged in it at all. Before the seal appeared, that conversation could doubtlessly have been considered totally inconsequential. But after the seal? Oh, Berlioz, Berlioz, Stjopa's brain was seething. The thought would never have entered my head. But this was not the time for prolonged grief, and Stjopa dialed the office number of Rimsky, the financial director of the Variety Theater. Stjopa was in a delicate situation. First of all, the foreigner might be offended that Stjopa was checking up on him after he had shown him the contract. And besides, it was extraordinarily hard for him to broach the subject to the financial director. After all, he could hardly come right out and ask, "Tell me, did I sign a contract yesterday for 35,000 rubles with a professor of black magic?" That would hardly do. "Yes," sounded Rimsky's sharp, unpleasant voice in the receiver.
"Hello, Grigory Danilovich," said Stjopa softly. "This is Likhodyeyev. This is the situation. I have this, artiste Volant here, and I wanted to ask about this evening."
"Ah, the fellow who does black magic?" echoed Rimsky's voice in the receiver. "The posters will be ready right away."
"Okay," said Stjopa in a weak voice. "Well, bye then."
"Will you be in soon?" asked Rimsky.
"In half an hour,"
Stjopa replied, and hanging up the phone, he pressed his hands to his burning head.
Oh, what a nasty business it all was. And what, citizens, was happening to his memory, huh?
However, it was becoming awkward to stay in the hall any longer, and Stjopa devised a plan on the spot. Do everything necessary to conceal his incredible forgetfulness. And now, first of all, subtly pump the foreigner for information regarding the kind of act he intended to perform that night in Stjopa's Variety Theater. As Stjopa turned away from the phone, he looked in the hall mirror, which the lazy Grunya had not cleaned for some time, and distinctly saw a weird-looking fellow, thin as a lath, and wearing a pince-nez. Oh, if only Ivan Nikolaevich had been there, he would have recognized the fellow right away. His reflection appeared and disappeared in an instant. Anxious, Stjopa peered into the depths of the hallway and reeled a second time, for he saw a hefty black cat pass by in the mirror and also disappear. Stjopa's heart skipped a beat. He lost his balance. "What's going on?" he thought. "Could I be losing my mind? Where are these reflections coming from?" He peered into the hall and shouted in fright, "Grunya, what's that cat doing in our house? Where did he come from, and who's the fellow with him?"
"Don't be upset, Stepan Bogdanovich," a voice sounded, not Grunya's, but that of the guest in the bedroom. "That cat belongs to me. Don't be nervous. And Grunya isn't here. I sent her to Voronezh. She was complaining that you hadn't let her go on vacation for a long time."
These words were so unexpected and absurd that Stjopa decided he had not heard them correctly. In a state of total confusion, he trotted back to the bedroom and froze in the doorway. His hair stood on end, and fine drops of sweat appeared on his brow. His guest was no longer alone in the bedroom, but had been joined by a retinue. Sitting in the other chair was the same oddball who seemed to have appeared in the hall. Now he was clearly visible, a feathery mustache, one lens of his pince-nez glistening and the other missing entirely. But there were worse things to be seen in the bedroom. Sprawled, in a relaxed pose on the pouf that had once belonged to the jeweler's wife, was a third creature, namely, a black cat of horrific proportions, with a glass of vodka in one paw and in the other a fork on which he had speared a pickled mushroom. The light, dim as it was in the bedroom, began to fade altogether in Stjepa's eyes. "So, this is what it's like to go crazy," he thought, and grabbed onto the doorframe. "Do I note a touch of surprise, my dearest Stjepan Bogdanovich?" Voland inquired of Stjepa, whose teeth were chattering. "But there is nothing to be surprised about. This is my retinue." At this point, the cat drank down his vodka, and Stjepa's hand began to slip down the doorframe. "And my retinue needs space," Voland continued, "which means that one of us in this apartment is superfluous. And I think that someone is you."
"It's them! It's them!"
crooned the thin, checked man in a bleating voice, referring to Stjepa in the plural.
"In general, they've been acting like swine lately. They get drunk, use their position to have affairs with women, don't do a damn thing, and can't do anything because they don't know the first thing about their jobs. They hoodwink their bosses. And he runs the official car ragged,"
tattled the cat while chewing on a mushroom. And at this point, the fourth and last phenomenon occurred in the apartment, just as Stjepa, who had already slid down to the floor, was clutching feebly at the doorframe. Right out of the mirror stepped a short but unusually broad-shouldered man. He was wearing a bowler hat and had a fang sticking out of his mouth, which made his already loathsome face look even uglier. To top it all off, he had fiery red hair.
"I," the newcomer joined in the conversation, "don't really understand how he ended up a director."
The redhead's voice became more and more nasal.
"He's as much a director as I'm a bishop."
"You don't look like a bishop, Azazello," noted the cat as he piled his plate with sausages.
"That's just what I'm saying," said the redhead through his nose,
and turning to Voland, he added respectfully,
"May I have permission, monsieur, to throw him out of Moscow straight to hell?"
"Shoo!"
roared the cat suddenly, his fur standing on end. And then the bedroom began to spin around Stjepa. He hit his head on the doorframe, and as he was losing consciousness, he thought, "I'm dying." But he did not die. He opened his eyes slightly and saw that he was sitting on something made of stone. A sound could be heard nearby. When he opened his eyes properly, he realized that it was the sound of the sea, and that a wave was, in fact, breaking at his very feet, that, to be brief, he was sitting at the end of a jetty, and that a blue sky was sparkling above him, and behind him was a white city nestled in the hills. Not knowing the proper behavior in such circumstances, Stjepa raised himself on his shaky legs and set off down the jetty to the shore. A man was standing on the jetty, smoking a cigarette and spitting into the sea. He gave Stjepa a strange look and stopped spitting. Then Stjepa resorted to the following maneuver. He dropped on his knees in front of the unknown smoker and said,
"Please, tell me, what city is this?"
"Are you kidding?" said the heartless smoker.
"I'm not drunk," Stjepa replied hoarsely. "Something's happened to me. I'm sick. Where am I? What city is this?"
"Well, Yalta." Stjepa sighed softly, fell over on his side, and struck his head against the warm stone of the jetty. He lost consciousness.
This ends Disc 3. The Master and Margarita, Disc 4.
Chapter 8. The Duel Between the Professor and the Poet. At precisely the time when Stjepa lost consciousness in Yalta, that is to say around 11:30 a.m., Ivan Nikolaevich Bezdomny regained it as he awakened from a long, deep sleep. He spent some time trying to figure out how he had ended up in this unfamiliar room with white walls, an amazing night table made out of bright metal, and a white window shade that was keeping out the sun. Ivan shook his head, realized that it did not ache anymore, and remembered that he was in a hospital. This in turn brought back the memory of Berlioz's death, but today Ivan was not as strongly affected by it. After a good night's sleep, Ivan Nikolaevich was calmer and had begun to think more clearly. He lay motionless for a while on his immaculate, soft, comfortable, spring-cushioned bed, and then noticed the bell button by his side. Due to his habit of touching things on impulse, Ivan pressed it. He expected to hear something ring or to have someone appear after he pressed the button, but something quite different happened. At the foot of Ivan's bed, a frosted glass cylinder lit up that said, "Drink." After staying put for a while, the cylinder began to turn until the word "nurse" appeared. It goes without saying that the ingenious cylinder made quite an impression on Ivan. The word "nurse" was replaced by "call the doctor." Murmured Ivan, not knowing what else to do with the cylinder, but then he had a stroke of luck. He pressed the button a second time at the word "doctor's assistant." The cylinder rang softly in reply, stopped, and then went blank. A stout, kind-looking woman in a clean white robe came into the room and said to Ivan, "Good morning." Ivan did not answer because he considered the greeting inappropriate under the circumstances. They had, in fact, put a perfectly sane man in the hospital, and yet were still pretending that it was the right thing to do. Meanwhile, without changing her kindly expression, the woman pressed the button once to raise the shade, and the sun streamed into the room through a light, widely spaced grill that extended down to the very floor. Beyond the grill there was a balcony, and beyond that, the banks of a winding river with a cheery pine forest on its opposite shore. "Time for your bath," said the woman invitingly, and beneath her hands the interior wall moved aside, revealing a bath compartment and a splendidly equipped bathroom and lavatory. Although Ivan had resolved not to talk to the woman, he broke down when he saw the water rushing into the bathtub from the gleaming tap and said ironically, "My, my, just like at the Metropole." "Oh, no," answered the woman with pride. "Much better. Even abroad you can't find equipment like this. Doctors and scientists come here especially to inspect our clinic. We have foreign visitors here every day." When he heard the words, "foreign visitor," Ivan immediately recalled the consultant from the day before. His mood darkened, and he scowled and said, "Foreign visitors. How impressed you all are with foreign visitors. But they come in many different varieties. Take the one I met yesterday, for example. He was a real charmer." He was on the verge of telling the woman about Pontius Pilate, but he restrained himself when he realized that it wouldn't mean anything to her, and she wouldn't be able to help him anyway. After his bath, Ivan Nikolaevich was given everything a man needs after a bath. A freshly ironed shirt, long underwear, socks. But that wasn't all. After opening the closet, the woman pointed inside and asked, "What would you like to wear, a bathrobe or pajamas?" Since he had been attached to his new abode by force, Ivan nearly clasped his hands in dismay at the woman's free and easy attitude, and he pointed silently to a pair of red flannel pajamas. After that, Ivan Nikolaevich was led down an empty and soundless corridor into an office of immense proportions, having made up his mind to respond to everything in this marvelously appointed building with irony, Ivan mentally christened the office the Factory Kitchen. And with good reason. It had cupboards and glass cabinets with shiny nickel-plated instruments. There were chairs of unusually complex construction, pot-bellied lamps with gleaming shades, a multitude of vials and gas burners and electric wires, and gadgets that would mystify absolutely anyone. In the office, Ivan was attended to by three people, two women and one man, all wearing white. First, Ivan was led over to a small table in the corner with the obvious intent of getting some information out of him. Ivan began to consider his situation. He had three choices. The first choice was especially tempting. He could lunge at the lamps and the intricate gadgets and smash them all to hell, and thus protest their holding him for no reason. But the Ivan of today was dramatically different from the Ivan of yesterday, and this first choice seemed dubious to him. It might even strengthen their conviction that he was a raving lunatic. And so, Ivan rejected this first choice and considered the second, give an immediate account of the consultant and Pontius Pilate. However, yesterday's experience had shown that people either did not believe this story or they distorted its meaning. And so Ivan decided against the second choice and opted for the third, seek refuge in proud silence. As it turned out, however, this was not fully possible, since willy-nilly he ended up answering, albeit curtly and sulkily, a whole series of questions. Ivan was questioned about absolutely everything relating to his past life, including such things as his scarlet fever 15 years ago. After filling up a whole page on Ivan, they turned it over, and the woman in white proceeded to questions about Ivan's relatives. It was a lengthy business. Who died? When and how? Did the deceased drink or have venereal diseases and all that sort of thing? They concluded by asking for an account of what had happened yesterday at Patriarch's Ponds, but they did not badger him, nor did they show any surprise at what he said about Pontius Pilate. At this point, the woman turned Ivan over to the man, and he took Ivan through another kind of exam altogether and asked him no questions at all. He took Ivan's temperature, measured his pulse, and looked into his eyes with some sort of light. Then another woman came to assist the man, and they injected something painlessly into Ivan's back, made tracings on his chest with the handle of a small mallet, tapped his knees so that his legs jerked up, pricked his finger and took some blood, stuck a needle into the crook of his arm, and put rubber bracelets on his arms. Ivan just smiled bitterly to himself and reflected on the stupidity and grotesqueness of it all. Imagine, he had just wanted to warn everybody about how dangerous the foreign consultant was and try to catch him. And the only thing he had accomplished was to end up in some mysterious office where he had to tell a lot of rubbish about his uncle Fyodor, who had been a chronic drunk in Vologda. Intolerable stupidity. Finally, they let Ivan go. He was taken back to his room where he was given a cup of coffee, 2 soft-boiled eggs, and white bread and butter. After he had eaten and drunk everything, Ivan decided to wait for one of the top brass of the establishment to show up, who would finally listen to him and treat him fairly. And show up he did, very shortly after Ivan's breakfast. Suddenly the door opened, and in walked a bunch of people in white coats. At the head of them all came a man of 45 or so, who was as cleanly shaven as an actor and had pleasant but very penetrating eyes and a polite manner. The entire entourage showed him attention and respect, and his entrance was therefore a very solemn affair. Just like Pontius Pilate, thought Ivan. Yes, this was unquestionably the headman. He sat down on a stool while all the others remained standing. "Dr. Stravinsky," the seated man introduced himself to Ivan and looked amiably at him. "Here, Alexander Nikolaevich," someone with a neatly trimmed goatee said softly, and handed the headman Ivan's sheet, which was covered with writing on both sides. "They've put together a whole case," thought Ivan. The headman cast an experienced eye over the sheet of paper, mumbling, and exchanging some words in a little known language with the people around him. "And he even speaks Latin, just like Pilate," thought Ivan sadly. Here, one word made him shudder, and that was the word schizophrenia, which had alas been uttered yesterday by the damned foreigner at Patriarch's Ponds and was repeated here today by Professor Stravinsky. "And he knew that, too," Ivan thought anxiously. The headman had obviously made it a policy to agree with and be delighted by everything the people around him said, and to express his delight with the words, "Splendid, splendid." "Splendid," said Stravinsky, returning the sheet to someone and addressing Ivan. "You are a poet?" "Yes, a poet," replied Ivan gloomily, and for the first time he felt a sudden and inexplicable aversion to poetry, and the poems of his which came to mind seemed somehow distasteful. Wrinkling his face, Ivan responded by asking Stravinsky, "And you are a professor?" To this, Stravinsky gave an obligingly polite nod. "And are you the person in charge here?" Ivan continued. Stravinsky nodded again. "I must speak with you," said Ivan Nikolaevich in a meaningful way. "That's why I'm here," replied Stravinsky. "This is the situation," began Ivan, feeling that his hour had come. "They've decided that I'm crazy and no one wants to listen to me."
"Oh, no, we'll give you our full attention," said Stravinsky earnestly and soothingly. "And we certainly won't let anyone say you're crazy."
"Then, listen, yesterday evening, at Patriarch's Ponds, I met a mysterious person, perhaps a foreigner, perhaps not, who knew about Berlioz's death before it happened, and who knew Pontius Pilate personally."
The entourage listened to the poet in silence, without moving a muscle. "Pilate? The Pilate who lived in the time of Jesus Christ?" asked Stravinsky, narrowing his eyes at Ivan.
"Yes, the very same."
"I see," said Stravinsky. "And this Berlioz was killed under a streetcar?"
"Yes, he was the man I saw cut in two by a streetcar at Patriarch's Ponds yesterday, when this most mysterious fellow..."
"The one who knew Pontius Pilate?" asked Stravinsky, whose powers of comprehension were obviously very high.
"Precisely," confirmed Ivan, studying Stravinsky. "As I was saying, he knew ahead of time that Anushka had spilt the sunflower oil. And it was there, on that very spot, that he slipped and fell. How do you like that?"
Ivan asked meaningfully, hoping that his words would produce a big effect. But they did no such thing, and Stravinsky simply asked the following question. "And who is this Anushka?" This question disconcerted Ivan somewhat, and he grimaced.
"Anushka is of no importance in this matter," he said nervously. "The devil knows who she is. Just some foolish woman from Sadovaya Street. Don't you understand? The important thing is that he knew in advance about the sunflower oil. Do you understand me?"
"I understand you perfectly," Stravinsky replied in a serious tone, and touching the poet's knee, he added, "Don't get excited. Go on."
"I will," said Ivan, trying to imitate Stravinsky's tone and knowing from bitter experience that staying calm was the only thing that would help him. "So this horrible character, who is lying, by the way, about being a consultant, possesses some kind of extraordinary power. For example, if you chase him, you can't ever catch him. And he's got quite a pair with him who have their own special charm, a tall guy with broken eyeglasses, and a tremendously huge cat who rides streetcars by himself. What's more," Ivan spoke with greater fervor and conviction when no one was interrupting him, "he was on Pontius Pilate's balcony himself, no doubt about it. What do you make of that, huh? He should be arrested right away, or else he'll cause indescribable harm."
"So you are trying to have him arrested? Have I understood you correctly?" asked Stravinsky.
"He's clever," thought Ivan. "You have to admit there are some smart people even among the intelligentsia. No denying that." And he replied, "Absolutely correctly. Judge for yourself what else is there to do. But meanwhile, they're holding me here by force, shining lights in my eyes, washing me in tubs, and asking me questions about my Uncle Fyodor. And he's been dead for years. I demand to be released immediately."
"Well, splendid. Splendid," replied Stravinsky. "It's all clear now, and really, what sense is there in keeping a sane man in the hospital? So I'll release you immediately if you tell me you're normal. You don't have to prove it, just say it. So then, are you normal?"
There was complete silence. The fat woman who had taken care of Ivan that morning looked at the professor with pious respect, and again Ivan thought, "Very clever." The professor's offer was very attractive. But before answering, Ivan thought very hard, wrinkled his brow, and finally said firmly, "Yes, I am normal."
"Well, that's splendid," Stravinsky exclaimed with relief. "And if you are, let's reason this out logically. Take yesterday, for example." At this point he turned
and was immediately handed Ivan's sheet. While trying to find a stranger who told you he was an acquaintance of Pontius Pilate, you did the following. Here, Stravinsky began bending his long fingers, looking first at the chart, then at Ivan. You hung an icon on your chest. Is that right? Yes, Ivan agreed sullenly. You fell off a fence and hurt your face. Right? Appeared at a restaurant with a lighted candle in your hand, wearing only underwear, and then hit one of the people in the restaurant. You were tied up and brought here. Once you got here, you called the police and asked them to send machine guns. Then you tried to throw yourself out the window. Is that right? Now I ask you, is it possible to catch anyone or arrest them by acting that way? And if you're a normal person, you can answer that yourself. No, it isn't. Do you wish to leave here? Be my guest. But may I ask, where will you go? To the police, of course, replied Ivan, but not so firmly as before, and losing his composure a bit beneath the professor's gaze. Straight from here? I guess so. And won't you stop off at your apartment? Asked Stravinsky quickly. No, there's no time for that. Well, I'm going to apartments. You'll get away. I see. And what's the first thing you will tell the police? About Pontius Pilate, answered Ivan Nikolaevich, and his eyes clouded over. Well, a splendid idea, exclaimed Stravinsky agreeably, and turning to the fellow with the goatee, he gave the order, Fyodor Vasilyevich, please issue a release for Citizen Bezdomny so that he can return to the city, but leave his room unoccupied and don't change the sheets. Citizen Bezdomny will be back here in 2 hours. Well, he turned to the poet, I won't wish you success because I don't for a minute believe you'll have any. See you soon. And he stood up while his entourage began to stir. Why do you think I'll be back? Ivan asked anxiously. Stravinsky seemed to be waiting for that question because he resumed his seat and began talking. Because as soon as you appear at the police station in your long underwear and say that you met a man who was personally acquainted with Pontius Pilate, they'll have you back here in an instant, and you'll find yourself in this very same room. What does my underwear have to do with it? Asked Ivan, looking around in distress. The main problem is Pontius Pilate, but the underwear doesn't help. We'll have to remove your hospital clothes and give you back your own. And you were brought here in long underwear, and you had no intention of stopping off at your apartment, although I hinted that you should do so. Then comes Pilate, and the case is complete. At this point, something strange happened to Ivan Nikolaevich. His will seemed to give way, and he felt that he was weak, that he needed advice. So, what should I do? He asked, but timidly this time. Now, that's splendid, Stravinsky replied. A most reasonable question. Now I shall tell you what really happened to you. Someone gave you a real fright yesterday and upset you with that story about Pontius Pilate and other things. And so you, a morbidly sensitive and nervous individual, went around the city talking about Pilate. It's completely natural that you should be taken for a madman. Only one thing can save you now, and that's complete rest. You definitely need to stay here. But he has to be caught, exclaimed Ivan imploringly. Fine, but why do you have to run after him yourself? Write down all your suspicions and accusations against this man on a piece of paper. There's nothing simpler than to send your statement to the proper authorities, and if, as you claim, we are dealing with a criminal, that will soon be apparent. But there's one condition. Don't overstrain yourself, and try to think less about Pontius Pilate. All sorts of stories can be told. Not all of them have to be believed.
I understand, Ivan announced decisively. Please give me some paper and a pen.
Give him some paper and a short pencil, was Stravinsky's order to the fat woman, and to Ivan he said this. I advise you not to write today.
No, no, it has to be today, absolutely today, Ivan squealed in agitation.
Well, all right, only don't overtire your brain. If it doesn't work out today, it will tomorrow.
He'll escape!
Oh, no, Stravinsky retorted confidently. He won't go anywhere, I assure you. And remember that here we shall assist you in every way that we can, and without that, nothing you do will work out.
Do you hear me?
Stravinsky asked abruptly, lending special significance to his words and grabbing hold of both Ivan Nikolaevich's hands. As he held them in his own, he stared long and intensely into Ivan's eyes and repeated, You'll be helped here. Do you hear me? You'll be helped here. You'll get relief. It's quiet here. Everything is peaceful. You'll be helped here. Ivan Nikolaevich unexpectedly yawned, and his expression softened.
Yes. Yes, he said quietly.
Now that's splendid, concluded Stravinsky in his usual fashion and got up. Goodbye. He shook Ivan's hand, and as he was walking out of the room, he turned to the man with the goatee and said, Yes, and try oxygen and baths. A few moments later, Ivan was alone, without Stravinsky or his entourage. Beyond the window grill, the joyous and vernal wood on the opposite bank looked radiant, and nearer by, the river sparkled in the noonday sun. Chapter 9. Karavyov's Tricks. Nikanor Ivanovich Basoy, chairman of the House Committee of 302B Sadovaya Street in Moscow, the residence of the late Berlioz, found himself inundated with problems, which had started during the night between Wednesday and Thursday. At midnight, as we already know, Zhildyibin arrived as part of a commission which summoned Nikanor Ivanovich, informed him of Berlioz's death, and then went with him to apartment number 50. There the papers and belongings of the deceased were put under seal. Neither Grunya, the maid, nor the frivolous Stepan Bogdanovich was in the apartment at the time. The commission told Nikanor Ivanovich that they would remove the deceased's papers in order to sort them out, that the deceased's living space, that is to say his three rooms, the study, living room, and dining room that had once belonged to the jeweler's widow, would revert to the House Committee, and that the deceased's belongings would be kept where they were under seal until notification of the heirs. News of Berlioz's death spread throughout the building with supernatural speed, and Basoy started getting calls at 7 o'clock Thursday morning. Then people began showing up in person to submit claims for the vacated rooms. Within 2 hours, Nikanor Ivanovich had received 32 such claims. They contained pleas, threats, slanderous gossip, denunciations, offers to undertake renovations at their own expense, references to unbearable overcrowding and the impossibility of sharing an apartment with bandits. Included, too, was an artistically powerful and gripping account of someone stealing pelmeni from apartment number 31 and stuffing them into a jacket pocket, plus two threats of suicide and one confession of a secret pregnancy. Nikanor Ivanovich was constantly being called out into the hall of his apartment, grabbed by the sleeve, whispered to, winked at, and promised a little something for his efforts. This torment lasted until noontime, when Nikanor Ivanovich simply fled from his apartment and went to the office at the main entrance, but when he saw people were on the lookout for him there as well, he took off again. After managing somehow to escape the people who chased him across the asphalt courtyard, he took refuge in entranceway number 6, and then climbed upstairs to the 5th floor and that vile apartment, number 50. After catching his breath on the landing, The corpulent Nikanor Ivanovich rang the bell, but no one came to the door. He rang a second time and a third, and began grumbling and cursing under his breath. Even then no one answered. Finally, he lost his patience, took a bunch of duplicate keys belonging to the housing administration out of his pocket, opened the door authoritatively, and walked in. "Hey there, maid!" Nikanor Ivanovich shouted in the semi-dark hallway. "What's your name? Grunya, is it? Are you there?" No one replied. Then Nikanor Ivanovich took a folding ruler out of his briefcase, removed the seal from the study door, and stepped inside the room. Or rather, he was just starting to step inside when he stopped in amazement in the doorway and even gave a shudder. Sitting at the deceased's desk was a stranger, tall and emaciated, and wearing a checked jacket, jockey cap, and pince-nez. Well, in short, you know who.
"And who might you be, citizen?"
asked Nikanor Ivanovich in a frightened voice. "Hello, Nikanor Ivanovich!" the unexpected citizen called out in a quavering tenor, and leaping to his feet, he greeted the chairman with an abrupt and forceful handshake. Nikanor Ivanovich was hardly enthralled by this welcome.
"Excuse me," he began suspiciously, "but who exactly are you? Are you here in an official capacity?" "Ah, Nikanor Ivanovich," the stranger exclaimed confidingly, "how do you define official and unofficial? All that depends on your point of view. All that is arbitrary and relative. Today I'm unofficial, but tomorrow I might be official. And vice versa, of course, or even something worse."
This kind of reasoning gave no satisfaction whatsoever to the chairman of the House Committee. A suspicious person by nature, he decided that the bombastic citizen was certainly unofficial and maybe even superfluous. "So who are you? What's your name?" the chairman asked with increasing severity, and even began to bear down on the stranger.
"My name is," replied the citizen, unperturbed by the severity of tone, "well, let's say, Kuravyov. And wouldn't you like a bite to eat, Nikanor Ivanovich? No need for ceremony, huh?"
"I beg your pardon," began Nikanor Ivanovich, by now indignant, "but what in hell does a bite to eat have to do with this?"
However unpleasant it may be, one must admit that Nikanor Ivanovich was by nature somewhat rude.
"You have no right to be in the deceased's quarters. What are you doing here?"
"And won't you sit down, Nikanor Ivanovich?"
cried the citizen, without losing his composure and making a great display of offering the chairman a seat. Absolutely enraged, Nikanor Ivanovich refused to sit down and shouted, "Who are you, anyway?"
"I serve, if you please, as an interpreter for the foreign visitor currently residing in this apartment,"
explained the fellow, who called himself Kuravyov, as he clicked the heel of his scuffed red shoe. Nikanor Ivanovich's mouth fell open. The presence of a foreigner in the apartment, and with an interpreter no less, came as a complete surprise to him, and he demanded an explanation. The interpreter was happy to oblige. The foreign artiste, Mr. Voland, had been graciously invited by the director of the Variety Theatre, Stepan Bogdanovich Likhodyeyev, to stay in his apartment for the duration of his tour, approximately a week, and yesterday Stepan Bogdanovich had written to Nikanor Ivanovich to that effect with a request that he issue the foreigner a temporary residence permit since he, Likhodyeyev, was going to Yalta.
"He didn't write me anything," said the astonished chairman.
"Just take a look in your briefcase, Nikanor Ivanovich," Kuravyov suggested sweetly. Nikanor Ivanovich shrugged and opened his briefcase and immediately found Likhodyeyev's letter inside.
"How could I have forgotten?"
mumbled Nikanor Ivanovich, gazing dully at the already opened envelope.
"It happens sometimes, it happens sometimes,"
cackled Kuravyov.
"Absent-mindedness, absent-mindedness and overexhaustion and high blood pressure, my dear friend Nikanor Ivanovich. I am horribly absent-minded myself. We'll have a drink sometime, and I'll tell you a few facts from my life story. You'll die laughing."
"When precisely is Likhodyeyev going to Yalta?"
"Why, he's already gone. Gone!" shrieked the interpreter. "He's already rolling along. Yes, indeed. He's already the devil knows where.
And here the interpreter waved his arms like a windmill. Nikanor Ivanovich said that he had to see the foreigner in person. But the interpreter denied him that request. It was impossible.